tonight's speaker. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Diane.
Okay. That'd be great. I get to tell Diane's story and not mine.
Oh, yes.
Just in case I need it. Well, hey. I'm glad it's a small crowd. I'm nervous. My name is Faye, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Faye.
And who knew I was going to cry first thing? You did. My sobriety date is October the 14th, 2021, so I'm still fairly new at this. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. We have worked the steps together. And I average about five to six meetings a week, and have kept that since the first of my sobriety. I don't know if I have to have them to stay sober, but I'm not interested in finding out. I know this works for me, and it has made the journey a lot easier. Being around people that are like me, that understand whatever comes out of my mouth, including if it's craziness or it doesn't quite fit, you know, at least you people know that I am in transition. I'm changing just like you are. And I've changed a lot. I grew up in a very religious home. I have two older brothers, older brother and older sister. They were 10 and 12 years older than I was, so I was the baby. My father introduced me as the fall crop. He was a tortured alcoholic. The religion that I was raised in was about two steps away from Pentecostal holiness. And the belief of the church was that if you lived in the right place with God and you followed the right prescription, you would live a perfect life. Perfection was achievable. And if you didn't have that perfection spiritually, you were doomed. There was nothing for you. That's fertile ground for an alcoholic personality, because we are somewhat perfectionists ourselves, or most of you that I've talked to. And so that was a little bit of a kickstart. I was still a precocious child. I didn't realize how self-centered until I got in the program, but I was a very self-centered child. My mother struggled with my father's alcoholism. He was not violent, in the home at least, and he was tortured about it. Because of the religion, he felt like this was a complete moral failing, and he was failing in his relationship with God. And so he was tortured about his alcohol. He stopped when I was about 16. He had gotten several diagnoses of, you know, poor health. He was 49 years old. And they put him on lots of fun medications, and he just became a zombie and took his own life after he had slipped and found that sense of ease and comfort one more time, and knew that he wasn't going to be able to live without it. I remember feeling that way when confronted with the finality of having to stop drinking. I didn't want to live. I didn't want to live without alcohol. I didn't want to stop drinking alcohol. It was my savior. It was my best friend. It was my best lover. It did everything for me. And I didn't want to quit. And I didn't start out drinking alcoholically. I've heard a lot of people in meetings talk about they remember their first drink and remember that it did for them immediately. It didn't hit me that way. I had believed from my mother's teaching that alcohol was the ultimate evil. It was the thing that had ruined my father and a good many of his family, and so alcohol was evil. I would not date anybody that drank. If I went to someone's home and saw someone walk around with a cocktail, I wanted to get out of there. I was terrified of it. But when my sister finally took me out and bought me a strawberry daiquiri, and I remember thinking that the daiquiri would have been great without the alcohol in it. It tasted horrible. It just ruined the drink to me. And I got no big boost. And then a couple years later, I was somewhere and somebody pushed a beer on me, and that was even worse. And so for a long time, I guess I was 20 before I took my first drink. I took the first drink that made a difference. And I remember the first time I'd gone to a company function. I was in hotel management at that point. And I remember leaving thinking, this is what it feels like to have a buzz. That's not half bad. That's not half bad. And that was it. And I would go out with other people because that's what they did. They drank, and I would get a drink, and I would nurse it for a long time and then put it down and maybe have two, maybe not. And this went on for quite a while. I guess I was it was at least 2 years later before it got started getting its claws in me, I would say. And it came about this way. It was first, well, if you're going to have a good time, it's going to be funner with a drink. And then, well, it's not really going to be a good time if we're not drinking, is it? And then that goes to, well, I just want to have a drink before we go. I don't know what this is going to be like, and I want to be there before I get there. And then from there, it was, I didn't want to go to restaurants if they didn't serve alcohol. Now, all this time, I don't remember, at this early stage, having episodes of being drunk. I'm sure there were times I had lots, but there was always a cutoff point for me. And I kept at it. Of course, I married a succession of alcoholics, because that's what we do. You know, you want to marry somebody that's going to make it a little bit easier for you to drink, and or at least feel better about your drinking, because they're drinking way worse than you are. And so back, I guess my kids were small, so be in the 80s or early 90s. And I didn't like the fact that it seemed like we were going all kinds of places. I was drinking more often during the week. You know, instead of just being once in a while, it would be 5 out of 7 days. We were going somewhere, shoot pool, or doing something, having a drink with dinner. And I remember thinking, you know, you do not want to be the drunk. You just don't. So let's go to AA. And so I went into the rooms of AA in Charleston, South Carolina. Big, big rooms. It's back when you could smoke in the rooms, man. And I do not remember. I guess I went off and on for maybe 5 or 6 months. My purpose in going was to regulate my drinking. I wanted to stop this before it went too much further. And so I was going to go to AA to learn how to regulate my drinking. And so I dutifully soaked everything. They never mentioned the steps. I must have been in the wrong kind of meeting. I only went to one location. Never talked about the steps. And I never got a sponsor. So that wore off. And I still was just, I would try to watch it. For years, I would watch how much I was drinking. And you know, I could maybe back off for a little bit. You know, I could back off for a while, and then I'd ease back in, and it wouldn't be bad. And then something would happen, and I'd get tore up and feel like crap the next day. And go, here you go. You're going to do just what your dad did. And I'd back off a little bit more. And so I had many years of the battle. And then my kids got grown and went on their separate ways, and I just wanted to drink. And I was an adult, and I wasn't hurting anybody, but I could drink all I wanted. And so I drank, and I drank a lot. And then I drank at work some. And then I found that if you're going to drink at work, you better find some other stuff to use to keep from being too obvious. So that led down a couple other paths. Divorced twice. When I would go into the church that I was raised in, and I would get really dedicated and, you know, go through the prescribed things you're supposed to do to get on the right side of God, and I'd get involved and teach Sunday school and, you know, hold seminars and stuff like that. And so for a period of about 3 years, I didn't drink. And I thought the problem was all over with. And I divorced number two. And he was such an asshole. I just needed a drink. I just needed a drink. And that became fun again. And, you know, this world is full of assholes, and I'm just a lot better if I have a drink. And so I drank. And then I drank more. And I would always set these boundaries, you know, okay? But first it was, well, I don't drink every day. Well, I blew by that one. And then, well, I don't drink before 5 o'clock. I never drank before 5 o'clock. I blew by that one. Well, I don't drink before noon. And I blew by that one. And pretty soon, it would be 10 o'clock in the morning. And I wasn't even drinking nice stuff. It was rot gut vodka. And it was straight. And it was 2 or 3 shots. So I could have the energy to do all the things I needed to do. It was my energy then. Okay, it had a purpose. I wasn't an alcoholic. This has a purpose. My family struggles with depression. This is just my medication. And I self-medicated. Well, reconnected. I was living in Charleston. And coming to the end of a 26-year corporate career, that's when the buyouts were happening and people were getting shuffled around and all that kind of stuff. And I got my butt on my shoulders and didn't like my new boss and walked out. And I was dating a guy that I knew in high school up here. And he said, why don't you move to Virginia? And he was a right good drinker, so I felt like that wasn't a bad idea. And so I moved in. We cohabitated, and we kept looking for a place in the country. We finally found a place in the country. And so we moved, and I got to Smithfield Farm. My dream, it is my personal dream. I love it there. And so this was going to moderate everything, right? Everything should be fine. I have what I want. I have a good career. Got into real estate. Was doing well. I'm going to be fine now. That was just a period in my life. And when we drank, somebody would cause a fight. Somebody would say something wrong or do something wrong. And then it became this every time we drank. We would drink together, and it would just be gnarly. We lived out there about a year, and I found out my mother was being financially abused by a sister, and so I went and got her, brought her up here to live, and she stayed with me till she died. That was a challenge. She lost both her legs very slowly, and my daughter moved back home, and now I drank when mother went to sleep. I needed. That's how you unwind. And I would go up in my room and drink. She'd been there, I guess, about 2 weeks when I got the news that my 28-year-old son had been killed in Oklahoma by a drunk driver. And the trial itself, bringing that guy to justice, took 5 years. We're going to Oklahoma, it's going to be the trial. No, he got a continuance. And I could... to make the trip. I can make decisions. I knew when I needed to be sober. And it was still at the capacity to manufacture some level of sobriety when things had to happen. I remember thinking, I'm not going to give in to just drinking all the time. I've got the greatest excuse in the world. I'm not going to be that person. I'm just not going to do it. And I think it was held at bay. I think my progression was held at bay for whatever God's reasons were. And I got involved in lots of things in Smithfield and, you know, just was having a grand life just drinking all the time. And then people started commenting on how much I drank. You know, my daughter, how many of you had? Well, I've only had two. You always only have two, okay? Always only have two, maybe three. And not ever coming clean about how much booze was stashed in the bedroom and how much booze was stashed in the laundry room and how much booze was stashed in my car. Because while they say you're not supposed to drink and drive, my idea was you're not supposed to drive drunk. And if I don't feel drunk, I'm not drunk. And so I would get in my car and drive. And things started happening. I went into a ditch one night. And that's when the home front started getting crazy. My husband had gotten a DUI back in the 80s, and he would one beer and he won't get behind the wheel. And he's stuck with that ever since I've known him. My daughter does not drink. She's living at home, and she's now real invested because mom's drinking and driving, and she's real worried about it. And I knew by this time that this was killing me. I was starting to get some liver symptoms, starting to get some other health symptoms, and I knew, you know, 59 is not a good time to be doing anything you want. It's time to straighten up and fly right, and but I didn't want to stop drinking. I wanted the consequences to stop, but I didn't want to have to give it up. I didn't want to come into a room, which every time I thought of AA, it was like, I got to AA, I got to stop drinking. And I don't want to do that. And then there would be times when I didn't want to drink and I couldn't not drink. For a while, I would tell myself, well, this is just what you feel like doing. You're doing what you feel like doing. It's all right for you. Do what you feel like doing. It's nobody else's business. I didn't realize that at that point, years prior, I had lost the ability to stop. But the disease lies to you so well that it's just this or it's just this or all the excuses that you make up in your mind. And there are thousands. Why I'm going to drink. And I finally was leaving a Rotary function one night on 10, it's in Smithfield, right at Cypress Creek, if you know where that's at. It's a straight stretch of overpass to get onto 1032 to go towards Smithfield or go back towards Suffolk. And I had gone to this planning meeting and I'd had two drinks there, two Jack and Cokes. They weren't even doubles. And I even ate. And I now felt kind of woozy, so I thought it's probably about time to go home. It's about 8 o'clock in the evening. Hey, let's go home. And I got in my car and I got on the entrance ramp to get on 1032. There's two cop cars coming at me. I'm like, what are you guys doing on the exit ramp? Somebody must have called and set me up. I can't believe this. Because I felt like I was on the right ramp. My recollection is that I was on the right ramp, but if you look at the footage, no, I was on the other ramp. And the existence of those two cop cars kept me from entering traffic. And they asked me to get out of the car. And when I got out of the car, I started realizing, well, this is not just a buzz. This is a little bit bigger than just a buzz. And you want to do a roadside sobriety? No. No, sir. No, thanks. Well, we're going to ask you to... No, I'm not going to do that either. Well, how much have you had to drink? Have you been drinking? Yes. How much have you had to drink? Two. And that was the truth for the function. But I'd had a Jack about this big on an empty stomach before I left the house. So I was well on my way before I even got there. And I don't know what my BAC would have been. I kind of feel like I probably would be under the jail if I had not done that. Well, of course, you refuse a breathalyzer. You get to not pass go. You just don't get to drive until court date. And I decided that night, okay, this has really gotten out of hand. I have got to do something. And my daughter said, we'll go to AA. And I said, I would rather die. And she said, I don't know what you're going to do, but you're going to do something. And I did not want the consequences of that DUI. So I scrounged around the house and found a big book. I'm going to do this on my own. I don't need nobody. I certainly don't want to tell anybody my stuff. So I'm going to read the big book and I'll get this. I know how to connect with God. I know all that. And so I got it down. Every morning faithfully would read. But it's funny, when you're reading the big book by yourself, you skim over stuff. You know, you really go, yeah, well, that's not me. Or, yeah, that's me, but it's not that bad. Yeah, but that's okay. Yeah, I know, I can't drink anymore. I didn't get the powerless over alcohol part. I just knew Faye couldn't drink anymore. And so Faye called out good old willpower and reinforcing it with a big book. And I bought myself 5 months. 5 months. Now, every day of that 5 months, I'm wondering why life isn't rosy. I've quit drinking. You people have been bitching at me to quit drinking. And I have quit drinking. There is no liquor in my room. I'm done. Where's my trophy? You know, oh, look, it's day 5. I'm telling everybody every day, oh, it's day 10. It's month 2. You know, and nobody's changing. Nothing's getting better. And I'm miserable. So court date came. I didn't get off easy. Wasn't able to skate by. I got the full-blown DWI. And the puffer in the car, and the can't drive, and the SR-22. And I'd even pulled out $3,000 for a DUI attorney. But he told me, you know, we have one problem. When you appeared before the magistrate the night that they picked you up, you said, well, I could pull out a high-powered attorney, but I obviously shouldn't have been driving. Well, I might as well have signed a confession. You know, so there was no getting out. And I told the attorney when I called him, I said, look, I need to pay this. I did it. I was drunk. And I need the consequences to reinforce my sobriety. Well, when those consequences didn't come true, I did not feel good about 5 months sober at all. And it got worse. And I got angrier. And I got pissier. And I finally one day found myself right in front of the liquor cabinet. And I pulled head off Jack Daniels and took a big glug and put it down. And I thought, where's the big craving? I'm fine. I obviously made too big of a deal of this. I don't have a problem. I quit for 5 months, for Christ's sake. I'll be fine. And to prove that to myself, I didn't have anything else to drink for a couple days. Oh, I got this. There's no craving. After a couple days, I think I'm going to have a glass of wine with dinner. I can obviously handle a glass of wine with dinner. I'll be fine. And I had a glass of wine at dinner, and that's all I had. Now I've reinforced it again. Oh, see, everything is fine. I am not an alcoholic. It was less than a week before I had hidden another bottle of vodka upstairs and was hitting it at 10 o'clock in the morning. Of course, my mind made that seem completely okay and logical. This was a normal world. That's what's scary to me about the disease, is that while you're doing these absolutely ridiculous, crazy, dangerous things, your mind is making it all okay. This is fine. And reinforcing any thought that I am going to be able to drink like a normal person. So, out of desperation, the one I remember the most is I was still sneak drinking. Okay, I don't think they knew at this point. But, you know, they always know when you think they don't know. So, maybe they did. So, I had had a couple shots. Everybody came home. Dinner's being cooked, and I needed to go back upstairs. I needed another shot. And I knew if I went up those stairs, they were going to know that I was drinking again. I had no other reason to go up. And I fought that with every ounce of intelligence and willpower that I thought I had. And I couldn't not go upstairs. I couldn't not go. And when I walked up there and I opened the top, I thought, this is crazy. You could not come up here. Everybody knows. It's blown wide open. And you're an alcoholic. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. Well, I finished the bottle before the end of the night because I knew what was coming. And the next night, I went online and found out where there was going to be a meeting, and I went. My first couple of meetings were not what I would call real welcoming, but at this time I knew I was powerless over the alcohol. I had tried everything for 40 some odd years, and I was powerless. And so when I came into the rooms, I had step one. I knew I was powerless, and I believed this was my last hope. There was no other place I could go. And I told my family, I said, if I don't make 60 days, you're going to have to check me in. If I don't make 60, you got to check me in. I expected DTs from the amount of alcohol I was drinking. I don't know why I didn't have to go into a treatment facility, but I didn't. And that was October the 14th, when I finally went to a friendly meeting and picked up a white chip. Got a sponsor. Didn't know anything about her. She was the first person that says, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No." And she said, I said, "Would you be my sponsor?" And she said, "Sure." That's how I got my first sponsor. And so we started meeting once a week to go through the big book. Well, I think I'm ahead of the game. I've been reading this thing for 5 months, a little while back. So, you know, obviously we're just going to dive right in to wherever you start working these steps. Now, I have read this book for 5 months and still did not have the concept that there are 12 in order steps that you've got to go through. So the first meeting at her house, I was blown away when she said, "We're going to start with the forwards." And I thought, the forwards? What in the world could possibly be in the forwards? I've got to get some sort of something to keep me sober, because I felt like it was a white knuckle every day I might drink against my own will. So we started working, and I realized when you read the book with somebody else, you can't gloss over anything because you're going slow. You're listening to someone else read, and you're reading, and you get all the little nuances that are in that book, and the words seem to strike home better. For me, they did, than reading it on my own. And so the steps became real. And we got to some point, and she said, "Well, I think that you understand that you're powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable." And when I said yes, I broke down in front of this complete stranger, and I cried for 20 minutes. I felt like I was losing the only thing that had ever come through for me and always been there. And it's what I depended on. It was my pick-me-up. It was my let-me-down. It was relaxation. It was energy. It was go. It was stop. All those things. It was the thing that helped me not have guilt when I was running around on those three husbands. You know, it bought me a place in my mind that I could live with who I was without really knowing who I was. So I laid it down there. I gave it to God. And it was not long after that that I noticed that I wasn't thinking about a drink. I wasn't fighting it every single minute. I don't know when the obsession was lifted. I can't tell you the date and the time, any of that. But there came a point when I just realized, hey, this isn't horrible. I think I'm going to be okay. I think I might be okay. But still, I think for the first 6 months, I was terrified that I was going to do something to sabotage the program and I would drink. I was terrified of drinking. And that, while fear is never a good place to live, it was a good place for me to start because it changed my habits. I wanted to make sure there was nothing in my closet. I wanted to make sure, you know, and we get into the other steps, and I would apply those things like, oh, I can't lie anymore. I can't lie because if I lie, I'll drink. And that's honestly how I believed it for all that time. I just thought of something else and it left that quick. So, I started going to meetings, going to a lot of meetings, and I did everything that was suggested. Some of the things that were suggested you hear in a meeting, some things you try them on, and either it wasn't time for that yet, or it didn't feel right yet, but I never said that's wrong for me. I always said, okay, well, I'm going to do this until it feels right to do that. And then all of a sudden you'll find that it feels right to do those things. There's such a growth when you go through the steps. And I guess it was probably 6 months in before somebody asked me, you know, well, you got your first step. Yes, I'm powerless over alcohol. I said, "What your life is unmanageable." My life's not unmanageable. I don't drink. All the unmanageable left when I quit drinking, right? Because I'm pulling things together. I'm not, you know, I'm not doing the crazy stuff anymore. There's no war. There's no fight. What do you mean unmanageable? And this person looked at me and said, "Really?" And so I went home and I started looking up unmanageable and reading all I could get my hands on about unmanageable in AA. And I, yes, my life was unmanageable. It's still unmanageable. Because I can't manage anything. When I try to manage something, I screw it up. I mess it up. I mess it up for me and I mess it up for everybody else that's involved. I can't manage anything. And the only piece of manageability that I can hope for is when I turn my thought life and my will and my plans over to God as I understand it. That was a thought I wanted to go back to. Came time to turn my will and my life over, and I had a parting with God a long time ago. And when my son was killed, that was it. I wouldn't sit in a room if you said grace. There was no grace going to be said in my presence. And if somebody wanted to have a conversation about God, I had a lot of four-letter words to go along with it. I didn't want any part of it. But I needed a higher power. And I didn't buy the whole light bulb doorknob thing. I needed a higher power. And I didn't buy the rooms thing, because people are fallible. And I said, well, I know there is a God. I've known that all my life. There is one. And I have no choice but to try to get to know him. And so it started off with just, whoever you are, please keep me sober today. And at night, whoever you are, thanks for keeping me sober today. And it was like that for a long time. That's all there was. Time for decisions. I hope you steer me where I need to go. And that's the best I could do. That grew over time. That grew over time. And I'm sure I have a relationship with the God that I knew as a child, but I don't know him that way anymore. I don't know him as the guy in the white up there waiting for me to screw up so he can flick me over into hell and write me off his list. That's not who I have a relationship with. I have a relationship with someone who has shown me a lot of mercy and who steps into the gap as soon as I ask him to. But he's a gentleman, and he's not going to step in where he's not invited. And so I've spent a lot of time learning how to invite God into the situation, invite God into my mind, invite God into what I'm reading, what I should do next, how I should handle this, to invite it. And after getting some progress there, I came to understand through these rooms that the more I give him, the more I get. The more I ask him, the more familiar he gets in my life. And when you watch close, he has a wicked sense of humor. You know, little things that would only be personal to me would happen, and it would be hilariously funny. I knew God had put that in my life just to show me that I was not all that in a bag of rice. You know, so when I get knocked down, I feel like my higher power does it in a funny way, in a way that it gets through, but doesn't make me bitter. It doesn't make me feel guilt and shame. I don't feel guilt and shame. And that was the first promise that astounded me about this program, is we will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. Can you imagine not regretting 40 years of drinking and all of the mess that came with that, and not dreading somebody bringing it up? And I don't. That promise has come true for me. And again, I can't tell you when that happened, but it happened. And it happened, I believe, from coming into these rooms and doing what was suggested that I do. I listened to a lot of AA speakers in my car. I've not grown up enough to go back to the music that I loved. I keep that stuff off still. And if I'm taking a long trip, I've got an AA book on Audible on the car. And there's so much richness in those other speakers, in listening to the books about AA and about the steps and the traditions. There's so much richness there, I never get bored. And I was the kind of person that got bored very easy. And when I got bored, then whatever it was that I got bored with was not worth my time. And I never get bored with this. I never get bored talking to people about it, listening to their stories, and going to places where there are other alcoholics, and they're telling me what they're struggling with or what they've just discovered in AA. It never bores me anymore. I am a calmer person. I don't have the rage, and that's because it terrified. I believed, like they said, anger, and I was going to drink, and so I avoid anger. And a few months ago, I was sitting in my living room, didn't have the TV on, I'm just looking around. I think I'd had my morning devotion, and I was looking around, and I thought, some drunk woman decorated this house. And it's the truth. A drunk woman decorated my house. It was me. And half that stuff I don't like. It's amazing how it not only does it change who you know you are, it changes things you don't even know it's changing before and after. And so now it's going through, and food, there are foods that I always thought I liked that now I can't stand. There are things I never ate that all of a sudden I'm like, well, yeah, it's not bad. I wonder why I hated that. It's a revolution in my life. And it's not something I pictured that it would be I'm going to go to AA and I'm going to struggle until I get enough time behind me and I'll just be one of those dull people that doesn't have any fun. And I'll power through. I ain't got that many years left. But it's not that way at all. There's learning along the way. I don't recriminate myself when I make a mistake. When drinking and I made a mistake, I beat the fool out of myself. You know, I hated myself. Not only for the alcohol, but for the things that surrounded it, the things that I allowed, the things that it made me do. I don't have any of that anymore. I don't walk around with a guilty conscience. When came time to make amends, I made amends, and I learned that there is time and place for amends. And you let your sponsor guide you through that. Because doing it on your own, I've heard from many people, is a nightmare. And if the few that I tried to just, this is the biggest one, I'm going to handle this one, and then I've got the biggest one done. No, it didn't work that way. It was a mess. It was a total mess. But cleaning up the past with the hope that you won't do it again. I have the hope now that it won't happen again, when I didn't have that before. It was, you know, yeah, I'm sorry I got so tore up last night. I'll try to do better next time, you know, or I'm not going to get that tore up anymore, you know, and none of that comes true. You can't manage it. It's unmanageable. I really am enjoying, I guess the step that I've enjoyed the most is 10 and 11 in the daily checkup thing. I find that so positive. I imagine that would be a negative thing in reading ahead. Well, when I get to 10, and I get to think about all the how horrible I am several times a day. But it wasn't that way at all. I like the discovery of, you know, I really could have done that, but I could have said that better. I really should have reacted differently to that situation. And now I can get up in the morning and go and say, hey, I'm sorry. I really reacted. I reacted poorly, and I apologize. And it feels good to do those things when before it was a nightmare. I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine doing it. My family has come around. I have a great relationship with my daughter. My husband is still drinking, but he will incorporate some of the things that I bring home from a meeting. We had a septic tank issue right before Christmas. And it would look to be, it was going to be an expensive fix. And my husband pinches pennies till Lincoln screams. So I'm dreading having to hear from him how bad it's going to be. Oh, you know, he's one of those people that his bank account gets to this place and he starts acting like we're not going to eat for 6 months when there's enough money there to eat for a year. He's never had to live poor. He don't know how much he's got. So I was just dreading that whole thing, and I kept telling him, look, I'm just grateful we have the resources to fix it. It's not going to be the worst thing in the world. All right, it happens. And he comes in the kitchen, and I had to come in for the third time and say, well, they're digging up the pump. They're going to have to replace the pump. And I could just see him. He's falling over on the table. And then he gets up. I'm in the kitchen. He gets up, and he comes in, and he said, you know, I listen when you talk about what you get out of AA. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah. You know, I'm just grateful we've got the resources to do this. And I'm just grateful that it's not the worst thing in the world. And, you know, we're blessed. We truly are blessed, and I just need to focus on that. And I almost fainted on the floor. You know, because I'll come home and say, well, how was your meeting? And I'll just share with him, you know, I had no idea this about this disease, or I had no idea this, or, man, I'm struggling with this, and I would just share it with him. And he would, you know, sit back there with his military eyes and just nod his head, and I'm thinking, yeah, you're worrying about what's the next car that's coming out. But they listen. My daughter has changed in some of the way she approaches life because she is watching me work this program. She watches me bite my tongue. She watches me relegate in traffic. You know, oh yeah, Willie, go ahead, go around. You know, let me pull over and you get off my butt, okay? And okay, they're going slow. It's okay, it's the country. You know, I just don't get wrapped up like I used to. And so she's adapting some of that, not as much as I'd like for her to, but some. It's far-reaching, the program is. It's far-reaching. And it gets better and better and better. I remember my first pink cloud. I had 3 months behind my belt, man. This was wonderful. And it wasn't a cocksure kind of thing. It was just, isn't this amazing? I've got 3 months, and I can remember when I couldn't make 24 hours. This is amazing. And everything's just great, wonderful. And then all of a sudden, you wake up, and life is real, Life is there. It's doing its thing. And you get to choose how to react. You get to choose whether you're going to hand it over to your higher power and let him handle it, or whether you're going to try to handle it. And I love to give things over to my higher power. But my problem is a lot of times when I give them over, now I'm still thinking about it. I'm still obsessing over it in my mind. And then I want to give God suggestions. You know I gave this to you, but how about if I do this? How does that feel? And how about if I handle it this way? How does that feel? You know, and I get nothing, of course. And I learn, though, when I can let it, when I can hand it to him and leave it there, not think about it anymore, that the solution just shows up in the smallest of things. I am very, very thankful for this program. I'm grateful for every face that comes in the room because I need you here. I need to see you. I need to hear what you have to say. I need the meetings. I need my higher power. And I need to be able to hold on to this hope that I've got that maybe I'm not going to drink again. As long as if I do these things, I've got some pretty good insurance that I won't. And I appreciate y'all coming out here to hear me, and that's about all I got.